Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We have on a guest that has been on in the past, and everyone probably already knows her, but this is Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and author of Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison. She is back to speak on some of the issues in the U.S. penal system, prison system, and also some of the comparisons between the countries in the Netherlands and elsewhere compared to mass incarceration in the United States. I had set this up earlier today, and unfortunately, I had canceled and I had to reschedule because I realized that we are in the process of time change in the United States. What I didn't realize is that they also have time changes in the other countries as well, in the Netherlands. So Mariam is coming on with us now according to her schedule. I had to cancel our schedule and reschedule. And this is a problem we have in the United States and around the world, inconsistencies once again. But Mariam, I want to thank you for coming on, even though I made an error earlier. It wasn't my error. It was the error of our governments. But if you can, just explain to the audience a little bit about yourself, and then we can get right into it. So Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and author, is going to be introducing herself as well. Mariam?
Hello, Leona. Thank you for having me on the show again. I always
So sorry for the confusion.
Well, confusions can happen in life, and let's not make bigger problems out of it. This can happen, and it's nice that we can do the show now.
Yes.
Well, for the audience, I am Mariam Jacobs. As Leona said, I am from the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands, I worked with incarcerated people as a psychosocial therapist because I do believe in the human being behind the crime, and in my conversations with my clients who are in prison, I always try to meet this person behind the crime. Prisoners have a lot of stories to tell, a lot to share. A lot has happened in their lives. That's why, you know, they come to that moment that they commit a crime. And I try to contribute to the awareness of incarcerated people, self-insight, as a form of rehabilitation. And I also work with people. I go to the homes of people who suffer, or not suffer, but who have autism, or ADHD or ADD. And with these people, I do the same, exactly the same as with incarcerated people. I try to contribute to the awareness of people and that they have the possibility to heal themselves. And these processes are beautiful to do because it really helps them to get to more understanding, more responsibility, and all that. So that's who I am. I wrote a book about the United States prison system, and I did a research for that book, and that book, that research was about the underlying structures of mass incarceration in the United States and the concentration camps in World War II, because 25 years ago I visited Auschwitz, and I think now it's 4 or 5 years ago that I was in the prison system in Florida, and there were some elements that I felt that were connected, and I wanted to understand if I felt it right, if my intuition was right. And after my research, I can say that there are elements that are the same, both in both structures that underlie the systems. And that was quite shocking for me to discover.
Thank you so much, Mariam. I want to let the audience know, people that come on this show are the experts that come on this show. And the reason I say this is because we hear about so many people on CNN News and MSNBC and Fox and all these people that have written books on issues that they have never even actually gone into witness. We have people on the show that have experience going into the prisons, have experience working with the incarcerated population, and have seen a lot of things that we have seen or heard of or have experienced ourselves or our loved ones. So one of the reasons why I have Marion Jacobs on the show and also Franz Dell from the Netherlands and others is because they have actually seen or witnessed it themselves. And Mariam actually volunteers at a prison in the Netherlands. She's been in the prisons in the U.S. Franz Dell has been. A lot of these people over in the Netherlands have been advocating for incarcerated individuals in this country. And we have many people in this country that should be helping or trying to find out why they did the crime. And we have so many people in this country that judge without even having a clue about these incarcerated individuals. People stereotype, and each and every case is different. We never know what's behind it. Mariam has also worked with or has also set up and has talked about deeper justice, and she will briefly go into that, I'm sure, today too. So again, let's have Mariam talk about what she does, what she's going to do, what she's been doing, so that all of you will get an opportunity to call in and ask questions, provide feedback, or just listen in. This is very important because even though we have people coming from other countries, they know all too well about the injustices in the United States prisons. So, Mariam, I'm going to give it back to you, and I thank you once again for coming on.
Well, you mentioned deeper justice. I will go into that. I call it deeper justice, and I came to that because first I work with restorative justice, and restorative justice is a well-known approach. It stands for the rehabilitation between or a healing process between offenders and victims. But I found out that there are a lot of other kind of therapies and approaches for victims they can go through before they come to the process of restorative justice, but there's not so much for offenders. And I think before somebody who has committed a crime is able to go through a real honest process of restorative justice, that person first has to have the ability to go to justice to him or herself on a deeper level. So deeper justice stands for doing justice to oneself on a deeper level. Because before somebody who has committed a crime, before that person can feel responsibility or sorrow, you know, towards the victim, he first really has to come to awareness of what did he do, what was the path that led to the crime, what happened in his life, all these questions that live deep inside people who have committed a crime. And that's why I call that process before restorative justice can take place. That's why I call that process deeper justice. And I think it's crucial for the incarcerated individual. So that's my view on this. I also work with what I call family constellations. Contextual therapy. I don't know if I say it right. I am a psychosocial therapist, so it means that I work with the psyche of people, but also with the context that somebody is living in and has lived in, because family, friends, you know, all the people around you are also of influence on the psyche, how somebody, you know, develops from youth to adulthood. You cannot see a person isolated. A person is always embedded in a social context. So you have to get more insight in the whole context. And
like
I think that's
crucial.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question on that. When you mentioned solitary, what are your thoughts on, because I know this happens often with people incarcerated who are thrown into solitary confinement when they have psychological issues to begin with. When they're thrown into solitary confinement and they're all of their properties are taken, their televisions or whatever, and they don't. I remember one time quite a while back on social media, they spoke about a person that had been in solitary confinement for, I think it was 400 and something days. And they said when they finally did let him out, he was barking like a dog.
Yeah.
I wanted to find out, as a psychosocial therapist, what are your thoughts on solitary confinement for people that are even restrictive blocks for people in that type of mental state?
Well, I see it as pure torture. You know, if somebody is outraged and very violent, then putting him into solitary confinement so he gets more calm, then solitary confinement is applied for the benefit of the prisoner. Also, of course, because of the safety for the other prisoners. But in the case, what you see in the United States, it's pure torture, because a punishment of 400 days or sometimes even years, that's not a punishment anymore. I mean, it's not related to what has happened before he got in solitary confinement. And, you know, it's scientifically proven that solitary confinement longer than 2 weeks is damaging the psyche of the individual. I mean, there's a scientific proof for that. So that's why in the Netherlands, we also do have solitary confinement, but it's the ultimate method to apply. If it's not necessary, if we can do it differently, we will do that. And if it has to be applied because of danger of other prisoners, or the person himself needs a timeout, a little timeout, it only can be applied for at 2 weeks at the most. Because longer than 2 weeks, it's going to damage the brain. And human beings are a social species. You know, we need other people to learn from, to interact with. If you take away interaction with other people, or if you take away the ability of make phone calls or visits with family or loved ones, that's not punishment, that's torture. Because a prisoner is not going to learn from these so-called punishments. He's not going to rehabilitate when he is in solitary confinement. That's nonsense. That's really nonsense. That's pure torture, and it only serves one goal, Leona, and that's suppression of the prisoners and the family in order to maintain mass incarceration. Why do you want to maintain mass incarceration? Because a lot of money is involved. So it's not about the prisoner. It's about the money. I'm sorry, but then I become very harsh in me because it's nonsense. Mass incarceration has no goal in itself. It serves nobody. Really, it serves nobody. It only serves the people who make a lot of money from it. That's the only goal. There's no other goal.
We actually had someone on the show the other day that pretty much mentioned the same thing you mentioned, as far as these large corporations, these people making money off of mass incarceration, Brother Hess. But these are some of the things that do occur in this country. I wanted to ask, too, for a lot of people that go into prison and they have had traumatic experiences as children or as adolescents, I wanted to ask your thoughts on this. They say when someone has been traumatized, they usually kind of like stay in that same age area where it happened, when it happened. A lot of times they don't mature beyond the time of the traumas, or they mature but they still have that childish mentality. There's been a lot of talk about raising the age of criminal responsibility to 25 or 26 years of age. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the brain of young people is still developing, and it goes on to the age of 25. So everything is different with, when it comes to children and young people. You cannot compare the brain of a young individual to an adult individual.
But in the United States right now, they're working on trying to raise the age, and because there are so many people incarcerated in of the mass incarceration, there are so many that went into prison under the age of 25 that ended up going to prison, and now they have been throwing them all in. But now there's talk about I think the Department of Justice has been working on some of this as well, but they're looking at raising the age of responsibility from, I believe it was 18, I believe it went up to 21, but there's talk about raising it to 25, 26 years of age. And there's people that went in under the age of 25, and they ended up with life and life without parole. So right now, many of them are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and there's talk about reducing the sentencing for people who are now over the age of 55, the elderly. And they're also looking at raising the age of maturity, criminal maturity responsibility to 25. And these are some things that are going on in the country. Whether it happens right away or not, I don't know. But I was just wondering what your thoughts are on when somebody is traumatized, someone has been violated or abused or whatever, there are people in prison that are maybe in their 30s and 40s, but still kind of like act or have the mentality of a 19 or 18 or 17-year-old?
The thing is, what's going wrong is that it's very difficult to make rules about this, because every crime is unique, because every person who commits the crime is unique. And that's what they don't look at. I mean, there are also here in the Netherlands, sometimes there are very young people, 16 or 17, who commit a crime, and then I'm so shocked. But they have their story, and these stories have to be heard, and they are not heard. It's very difficult to apply one rule on all these individuals. So, in fact, they should look at every individual separately. But what you have when you look at history, it was in the 60s or 70s, I believe it was in the 70s, that a lot of mental hospitals in the United States got closed. Mm-hmm. Because they developed all kinds of medicine for depression and all kinds of psychological issues. And so it was cheaper to give these persons this medicine and send them on the streets and close the psychological hospitals. And all these people, they end up in the streets, and finally they end up in the prison system. And that's what went wrong, you know. That's again about the money, and that's where you see it go wrong. There are a lot of people in prison who have really psychological issues, or are, I don't know what's the decent word, but in the past we called it mentally retarded, you know. Mm-hmm. People who they all end up in prison, and people with other problems like addictions and all that. So what we have in the Netherlands, we have forensic psychiatry, and that means that if somebody commits a crime, while he has mentally problems or really a mental disorder, or he is mental retarded, or he has an addiction, doesn't matter what kind of addiction, that's taken into account. And these persons get a short sentence in prison, but they end up in these forensic psychiatric hospitals to undergo treatment. And that's what's missing for the most in the United States. It's very, you know, it's cheaper to throw everybody in prison then have these forensic psychiatric hospitals. We pay a lot of tax money for these hospitals, but that's what we choose for, because they are our people too, and we want them to be really rehabilitated. So that's why we have these hospitals. We have another political system than in your country. That makes a lot of difference also in the prison system. You cannot compare. We also, we do have, you know, you see the difference in how we approach solitary confinement and how the United States approach it. You see it with life without parole. We do have people who have a life sentence, but there's, I don't know how many now, but before we give that, it's a very small part of the people who have life without parole. Then they are really proven to be, to maintain a danger for society or for themselves. And we have people who have a life sentence, they also get evaluated after 25 years. They have a chance to rehabilitate and might get out too.
If you believe this should be
Those are the differences. But, you know, our prison system, we don't make money out of bodies who are locked up.
I'm going to put myself, excuse me, Mariam, I'm going to put myself on mute while you are letting the audience know more about the issues in the prisons.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, thank you.
Audience, so what I mentioned here is differences between the Netherlands and the United States, but it's very difficult to compare systems, prison systems from different countries because, you know, the Netherlands has another history. It's a very small country. We have another political system. So it's very difficult to simply say the Netherlands is better than the United States. But I think what a very big difference is that in the Netherlands, we don't make money out of incarcerated people. And in the United States, well, it's the prison system in the United States is known as a million-dollar industry. What I also discovered when I researched on the ground structure of mass incarceration in the United States is that there's a lot of manipulation of amendments. The 8th Amendment says a lot about incarcerated people. For instance, the punishment and has to be the crime and the punishment have to be proportional. Well, if you send somebody in a solitary confinement for 20 years or something, it's never in proportion with the crime. So then you have the 14th Amendment. It's talking about equal rights for all the citizens. There's also a lot of manipulation in that, in the 14th Amendment, because it doesn't talk about citizens. It talks about people, about humans, and what I saw when I visited the prison system in Florida was that prisoners are seen as subhumans, and that's a very dangerous thing, because if you see a human as a subhuman, you can do whatever you want to do with that person. So I think the biggest problem in the United States prison system is that prisoners are no longer seen as human, and they are no longer approached as living beings. They are more approached like objects, and that makes it very difficult, because then you see all these things like guards who abuse men in prison, or who sexual abuse women in prison, because you can do whatever you want to do with these people. That in my research, I saw a similarity with the Jewish people who were also considered subhuman. And that's why they could do with the Jews whatever they want to do. And it sounds harsh. And I know this, you know, on the surface, the systems were completely different. And I realized that with what I say now, that Jewish people never committed a crime. They were innocent people. But the similarity was that both prisoners in the United States and the people in the war in World War II were approached as subhumans, and that makes it very, very dangerous. So I believe that Leona is back.
Yes, I was going to say that was an incarcerated individual from Pennsylvania. We get calls sometimes during the shows from people around the country that are incarcerated in Missouri. We have on Mondays, we have Reginald Clemens and some of the others that come on the show. They're doing some mentorship with the incarcerated that are coming out. And these Reginald and others that are doing the show, they are actually serving life, some on wrongful convictions and some on a first time or whatever. But I take these calls because right now it's like things are so frustrating for a lot of these people that are incarcerated with the things going on the outside and the things going on the inside, the injustices. So sometimes I have to kind of like put everything on hold for a few minutes. And you were talking about the reason people are in, and I want to talk about that, but we've got a caller. I'm going to get this so you can... 323, you want to state your name, please?
Yeah, hello, Leona. This is Joe.
Hi, Joe from Montana. I don't know if you've been on the show when Marion's been on before. Marion, are you familiar with Joe?
I'm not sure. Maybe. Hello, Joe.
Yeah. Hi, how you doing? I know the name, but I think maybe a few months ago, but are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Not doing badly at all.
Oh, okay, that's great.
So, Joe, did you get a chance to hear any of what Marion was talking about a few minutes ago?
Not at all. I saw your show, and I thought I'd call in to find, because I recognize your name, Miriam, because Leona brags about you all the time. So,
yeah, she has a bad habit of bragging, yeah.
I'll tell you, Joe, it's Miriam and it's all the others from the Netherlands that have been so instrumental in bringing about awareness of our own prison system in this country. They've had their experiences. They've been in the U.S. prisons. They've been doing work with others in the country, and so a lot of times. And I was mentioning earlier, when people write books on television, on the news all the time, they're called experts. And one of the things is when I listen to these people talk and they're asked questions, they say, "Well, I think," and I'm saying, "Experts don't think; they know." And when I have people on the show from the Netherlands, they know. But
you know, Miriam, why she brags about you.
Yeah, ask Leona. I don't know. She doesn't need to. I'm just who I am. I mean, I'm learning every day too. So since a few years, I try to understand why the United States has mass incarceration and how it works. And, as I think that Leona talked, I did write a book, a little book about, I did research. I have to tell it right. 25 years ago, I went to Auschwitz and I experienced what it meant to be suppressed and completely dehumanized. And it never let go of me. It's in my memory. And then about 4 years ago, I visited a prison in Florida, and I felt intuitively some elements who were similar. And I did research and tried to figure out if there are similarities in the structure beneath mass incarceration in the United States and what happened in World War II. I mean, I realized that both systems and both stories are completely different, but there were similar elements, and that shocked me. And that's, you know, I wanted to understand it, and so that's why I did this research. And like the dehumanization that I also felt when I was in the prison system in Florida, when I was in the visiting room, I felt it myself. As it felt, I was only a visitor, but I felt guilty. It felt as if I was guilty too. It's a sphere of guilt and dehumanization and suppression, and it's complete absence of human dignity. That's what shocked me. I experienced it, you know, and it, I will never forget it. I will never forget it. That there are physical realities, you know, physical places in this world where human dignity is completely absent. It shocked me to experience it by myself.
That's like Lowell Prison in Florida, the women, the female prison, where all those women were getting raped by the prison staff. That came out big time, and then all of a sudden it's gotten so quiet. So I don't know whatever happened with all that.
I don't know either.
Well, you know, with dehumanization, one of the reasons why I come to the show is because I'm not especially an altruist in this particular field. But I do realize that when people come out of prison, they are emotionally and psychologically unbalanced. And I think for the safety of the people that the ex-cons are going to meet, the ex-cons are formerly incarcerated, that they should have some sort of treatment so that when they do come out, that they're able to adapt as much as possible to the outside world, therefore reducing the threat to the American people. But the American people don't know what's going on inside the prisons, and if they do, they don't care. It's because we have a culture of lock them up and put them away. And I can't say that the American people are wrong for that. They, however, don't realize the dehumanization effect that you're talking about. Now, when you said you felt guilt, that doesn't bother me. I think anybody who goes to prison gets picked up by the cops should feel guilty, and should feel guilty before they've even picked up by the cops. And if they felt guilty enough, they probably wouldn't commit the crime that sent them to the prison in the first place. But the dehumanization, that is a way of making sure that somebody who commits a minor crime goes to prison, learns how to be a professional criminal, and when they come out, if they're not treated with dignity and with a form of humanity while they're in, they're going to come out with more resentment than what they had when they went in. So to me, it's not only a human rights issue, it's practically a common sense issue.
But when Marianne, I think when she was talking about... I think what you were talking about, Marianne, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were saying that you felt guilty. You felt like you were a prisoner in the treatment when you went in to visit someone.
Yeah. Yes, okay. That's exactly right. I think what I see when I work with incarcerated people in the prisons here, that what I find important is that somebody who has committed a crime, that he learns to feel truly guilty, not only saying the words that other people want to hear. And in order to feel really guilty, he has to go through that process of that he gets insight in what led to the crime. He did do the crime, and he always maintained responsible for what he did. But in order to learn what responsibility is, why did he not feel any responsibility when he committed a crime? Those are the questions that I have for incarcerated people, because saying that I am guilty is something else than feeling that I'm guilty and then saying from my heart, yes, I am guilty. Yes, I am responsible for what I did. I think only if somebody really comes to an understanding of what responsibility is, then he can heal himself inside and not commit a crime again, stay out of trouble. And that's a whole process. And not anybody can do it. There are also people who really cannot do it. They maintain a danger. But there are also people who can do that, who never learned it. What is responsibility? Or, you know, what is guilt? And what did I do, you know, to understand what you do to the victim? Really, from your heart. Not only saying the words, because we know it's easy to use the words, oh yes, I'm sorry, I did, I will never do it again. It's easy to say it, but can somebody really feel it?
And the thing is, what Joe was saying too, when they come out, there has to be something put in place for these people that come out. I mean, it's difficult when somebody is not transitioned back into society, but they're just released and they come out and there's nothing set up for them. And here they're going to mess up again in some way. And Joe, you mentioned mild crimes, nonviolent. One of the things is, like, I remember when I first started my organization in 2004, I contacted the courts, and there's people that get picked up for DUIs and things like that, and they have to do community service work. And that's what they should do with a lot of these people when they go to court, is not to put them in jail or prison for a year or 2 years or whatever, but give them community service hours and work to do while also making them go for counseling. And they have to have counseling agencies that are effective on the outside to work with these people. It's like those that are addicted. They get referred to substance abuse counseling, inpatient, residential. But yet there's such a big long list of people on waiting list that they don't get in right away. In the meantime, they can go out and get on some drug and do something violent and go to prison. So they need to open more facilities, long-term residential treatment facilities for mental substances.
You know what I was thinking also, because you reminded me of the conversation that we had a few days ago when I had brought up the topic about how do you find, and this is my question now to Miriam, how does anybody find, regardless whether you're a prisoner or ex-con or anything else, how do you find a very good therapist? Because it's so easy to become a therapist.
I know, yeah. That's a difficult question. It's a very good question, but it's a difficult question. Because, you know, what I believe in is the process to rehabilitation has to exist from a psychological part and a practical part. It's also, you know, the practical part is, how can I adapt to society? How can I live a decent domestic life? What does that mean? I'm not allowed to harm other people. What are my boundaries, but also what are the boundaries from somebody else? All these things. And besides that, there is this process of awareness. What I for myself find important when I go into the system here in the Netherlands is that I try to look behind the crime. Who is that person behind the crime? Because, you know, when I sit in the room with that person, he looks at me and I see a human being as, you know, the same as I he's as human as I am. So so the crime is very important to look at because it contains a lot of information. Who was that person while he committed the crime? Why could he cross these boundaries of other people? But it starts for me with getting to know that person. I never start with the crime. I always start with you. That's a big question. And I stay out of judgment, because if I'm going into judgment, that means then that the other person becomes paralyzed. Because when I say to you, you are a wrong person, then you don't need to do anything anymore because you are condemned. It's lost. So I always say judging is something that you do in court. I have another role. And sometimes it's difficult, you know, but because I'm also a human being and, I'm, you know, but I try to look at a person completely blank and open. I open myself up to who the other is. And from there, I can work with a person. And we also talk about crime. We also talk about what he did to another person, about responsibility. I mean, that those are very important elements of the process they go through. And it's not always working. There are sometimes men who are not able to do it. And then you get another story. Then you have to focus more on the practical side. So, as I said before in this show, is every unique, because every person behind that crime is unique. So it's so difficult to have one rule or one approach, because I try to adapt to the person who is sitting across me.
I'd like to ask you and Joe a question. Mariam, I don't know if you heard about the mass shooting up in Maine, Lewiston, Maine. I know, Joe, you must have heard about it.
Yeah, we had it too.
One of the things that bothers me with that is this man, he had a good reputation at one point in time. I guess he did some work in the military, but it was known prior to his crime, and this has happened with other prisoners that I've worked with and experienced with. He had problems, psychological problems, and so he ended up in a psych ward. But they said that they only kept him for 2 weeks and then they released him. Now, the people, the law knew about this man, and they knew that he was in a psych ward. But at the same time, why would the psych ward, first of all, release this man? He wasn't prepared to be released. And secondly, after the mass shooting, everyone forgot about this man and his unfortunate situation. I know that 20 people were killed and about 60 were hurt, but it just seems so unfair that he would be completely ignored as far as his unfortunate situation and his death. He committed suicide. But they mentioned all the families and they mentioned by name and everything, but they never once said this is a mental health issue that needs to be addressed. They never brought up the fact. They want to know why it happened. It happened because this man had psychological issues, and they completely talk over all of that. That there's so many people in this country that have psychological issues, and they talk over it when they're talking about these mass shootings, and they wonder why it happened. It happened because we have a pandemic, an epidemic of mental illnesses, and I can't understand why that is ignored in this country. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what I know from the United States, and I don't know if it's in every single state the same, but I know that for a lot of people, healthcare is difficult to reach because it's a money thing. There are a lot of people who have no insurance at all. I think... Yeah, it's always complicated. You cannot point at one issue or one thing and say that's to blame. It's a combination of, you know, things might have gone wrong in a psych ward. We don't know. He has been released too soon, or it might have been a money thing that he had to pay for it and he had no money. I don't know. And there is his own responsibility. I don't want to take away responsibility. Because if you take away an individual's responsibility, that's also harming. So it's more, and we don't know about the background of this person. It's far more complicated than we see on the surface. We only see the crime, but there is so much behind that crime that I cannot give one answer.
I think what we do know is that if a person does commit these kind of crimes, that they're hurting a lot. So then you have to ask yourself, why is this particular person hurting? Usually it's because, well, they may have extremely high expectations as a result of disappointment. They may consider themselves victims of the world. But in other cases, I would bet you that most of the people here, like, for example, the Columbine shooting, which I'm sure you're probably familiar with, Mariam,
there's a whole film about it.
Yeah, about schoolboys who were bullied for a long time and just couldn't take it anymore. So when you've been bullied or you've had to endure disrespect and physical and emotional assault for years, eventually there's going to come a time when there's the last straw that breaks the camel's back. And people are going to react. Now, that's my own.
They said that's what happened with him. They said everything came down at once. There were a lot of dynamics going on at the same time. But they said that there were
dynamics.
A lot of things happened to him at the same time. And like you said, Joe, sometimes, just like bullying, the Columbine, a lot of those mass shootings, they're because they were bullied and they were, you know, abused or whatever in the past, but they don't address it. you know, gun, it seems like mental health issues, addictions, and gun control or gun issues are all things that are completely ignored. And I'm not saying don't allow people to buy weapons, but have them go through extensive psychological evaluations, you know, before allowing them to have a license to practice or a license to carry. And these things are completely ignored. I don't understand why. And mental health, we have an epidemic of mental health issues in this country, and it's completely ignored. Every time crimes are committed like this, they say they're trying to figure out what caused it.
I don't know about that, Leona, because when I hear about these crimes and the articles that I read, they're always bringing up, why hasn't this person been receiving good mental health processes? And they use that as leverage to try to convince Americans that we shouldn't have guns anymore. It's always the anti, or let's say the pro-gun control crowd that actually focuses on victims and on those who commit the crimes as saying these people, they look at the trauma that the victims are going to now endure for the rest of their lives, and look at the trauma that this particular perpetrator must have had prior to the crime. And then they say that the resolution is gun control, fewer guns. Well, I'm a Second Amendment guy, and I believe that you need to have guns. You need to have guns against perpetrators, and you need to have guns against the government. So, but when Miriam talked about responsibility,
Don't you agree, though, an evaluation, it doesn't need to be put in a hospital for 3 days to be evaluated. But people get evaluated in maybe a few hours. They can tell, examine somebody to see what the mental state is. That's what I'm saying. Just to give permits, it's not. It doesn't seem right at all.
But that presumes that the mental health that they're going to give is somehow either successful or on its way to becoming successful or administered by people who care. I know of a couple of people in the one person was working inside a prison, and let me tell you, they don't care. After a while, they may have walked in there, you know, caring, but then after hearing people's problems all day long and then having to deal with convicts, they don't care. It's just a job, you know?
Yeah, you miss the human connection. Really care.
Yeah.
That's what you miss.
I remember there's a show... There's a show that was in Australia a few years ago. I watched a few years ago, and it was about the interaction between this female psychologist and the female prisoners. And she was doing a very good job. She cared for the prisoners. The prisoners cared for her, and she also made sure that the prisoners were to feel responsible when they were responsible, and were not to feel as though the whole world was against them when the whole world wasn't against them. She tried to administer some sort of reality to the prisoners. It was a good show, and it kind of made you feel that psychiatry, you know, might actually do some good, because there are people who do criticize psychiatry and psychologists as people who just, you know, enter the field simply because you could. You got your master's, you got your bachelor's, now you're academically prepared, and then, but when you come face to face with patients, especially people who are incarcerated, they have no idea what to do. And I don't think, you know, judging from that people who are in jail get any real kind of good, you know, therapeutic help.
I think that the whole prison, we talked about it before, Leona. I think that when you look at how they work, the other staff, like guards and so, how they approach prisoners. I mean, when you look at rehabilitation, I always say rehabilitation does not only take place in therapeutic sessions. Rehabilitation takes place 24 hours a day. When a guard meets, you know, he starts his shift in the morning by saying, good morning, did you sleep well, how are you doing today? That's rehabilitation, because then
need rehabilitation themselves.
What? Can you,
I said that the CEOs, they need rehabilitation themselves.
Yes,
they're part of the problem.
but they are part of the system. Everybody, the staff, and you have these stories about advocates, but also lawyers. They all are part of that system that maintains itself. It's all part of mass incarceration. That's why you have mass incarceration. It's one complete puzzle.
They are
all part of these. It's amazing, but that's what I described in my book, because I wanted to understand on a deeper level. And you can have a nice therapist or a psychologist once a week for an hour, but that doesn't rehabilitate you. A normal approach, decent approach. So when I am a visitor, not a prisoner, but a visitor in a prison, and I feel dignity, human dignity, that's rehabilitation for the prisoners. That has to be on a daily approach, 24 hours a day. Because then they learn on a natural way what is domestic life. How do we deal with each other? What does dignity mean? A lot of prisoners, when they have a traumatic youth, they might have never felt what dignity means. They don't know what it is. Yeah, they know the word. You can look it up. But what does it mean? How does it feel if somebody else approach you with dignity? That prisoners, rehabilitation means that prisoners don't hear it, but they experience it every day by the treatment of the staff. When you look at Norway, that's the ideal prison, the Halden prison. That's what they do in Norway. Approach prisoners just as human beings, because they are human beings. And they are just the other human being, but they are equal to me. When I go to my prisons, the prisoner is a human being like I am, and we are equal to each other. He is not less than me. He is another human being. He has the same dreams and the same wishes and the same needs as I have, and that's he has. A prisoner has to connect to his own normal human feelings and emotions like I have. And by approaching that prisoner, and I don't need to say so much, only by sitting across of him and he feels that he's equal to me, that rehabilitates that person. We don't need to go through difficult and high standard, all kinds of procedures and doing master education in psychology. It's just be human. Be human towards the other person.
Mariam. I'm glad you're saying this. We have a caller, but I want to say something before I bring them on. When I was doing social work, this is the difference between people that are really trying to help and people that are trying to impress. I used to be thin. Now I'm old and fat, but seriously,
me too.
They used to have me working with a lot of adolescents. So I used to wear my boots. I'd have my jeans, and I'd go into the homes so that the adolescents that I'm working with are going to relate to me. So I remember one time going in a home. It was kind of like a well-to-do home, and the kid was still in school. So I'm sitting down with the mother. And the mother's asking me all kinds of questions about my education and everything, because here I am in her home with jeans on. And so I told her, the reason I dress like this, I dress according to the type of person or the culture or whatever. And I said, the reason I dress like this is because I am going to be here for your daughter, not you, because your daughter's the one they had the chins case on, a child in need of services. So when the kid came home, we were on the patio outside the house, and the kid put their hand on her hip and says, I'm not working with you effing social workers. And I went over to her and I said, Andrea, I said, you're going to work with me. You and I are going to become the best of friends, and I'm not going anywhere until we are. But the thing is, when I had my clients, and then when I had to go to court, we had to go to court on that chins case not long after that. The mother was shocked then, because I walked in the courtroom with the skirt on, with the dress, with the briefcase, looking professional. I got a lot of respect from that mother after that. And there was another one in Sandwich on the Cape whose son was into drugs, and I got him into a facility in New Hampshire. But the thing is, when we go in to a home, and we're going to be dealing with a specific type of person or people. And we're going in there with our fancy clothes on and our fancy talk and trying to be professional to people that are threatened by the title or by your position. There's a lot of social workers that come out of college that have never been married, they don't have children, they come from prominent backgrounds, they're going into some dysfunctional homes. And when they go into these homes, they're going to tell these parents, whether it's a single parent or two-parent home, that they want them to go for counseling. We want you to do this, this, or this. Don't threaten a parent or parents, because then they're going to be resistant to you. So what happens? The social workers go back to their supervisors. In most cases, just like with the state, with the government now, the supervisor is going to side with their employee. And before you know it, it's going to be in court. Then there's going to be a care and protection. The child's going to be taken from the parent, put in a foster home. How many times have you heard about children being violated or killed or beaten or abused in foster homes? We had some very, very good foster parents, but you're going to find some are there for the money and you're going to find some are there for the kids. And that's the same way it is in the system. When these parents had to go for counseling, I would talk to them, first of all, to see if they had a family member that could be evaluated, that met with, to determine whether they would be good independent foster parents for the kids while the parent or the parents are getting the treatment they need. I used to try, one was the guy, he was 21 years old with tattoos all over him and everything. They had a little baby. When I went to the motel where they were staying, I had to look for the baby. They had to look for it. It was under blankets. They had coffee in the baby's bottle. But when I talked to them, I talked to them about getting the help. I also asked if they had a family member. He had a sister that was married to a fireman on the Cape. So I went and I met with them, and they agreed to be. This way they would be reimbursed for taking care of their own relative's child. I used to take the relatives to counseling myself to make sure they had no excuse for not going. There was one woman, a young woman that had a child. She was into drugs and alcohol. I gave her my home number. My supervisor said, you never do that. I got a call at 2:00 in the morning from the police department was at the house. She had two guys there. They were drinking. When the guys left, one of them went back and actually raped her. So it's not about so much the training. It's about the experiences. You have to be able to relate to the people you're working with. In the prisons, they're working with a lot of people, incarcerated individuals, who have been violated as children, who were beaten as children, who came from drug-infested communities, who had domestic violence going on in their own homes, drug-infested. They, all these things, they're going to go into a prison and they're going to get treated just as bad as they were on the outside. They're not going to get the help they need, and they're going to get more angry. So that's why I'm saying it's not all these things about, look at this, been law enforcement and there's been correctional officers that have committed suicide. And I think myself it's because they see their own peers doing dirt and they're too afraid or they can't deal with it themselves because there's some good ones inside, but they don't get the credit because they're not exposing the bad ones. And that's the same way in every situation we run into. Every situation. All it takes is a heart. No, it could happen to your own family member. And you would be so frustrated if you couldn't get the help for your family member. So we need to be able to show that kind of compassion. And like Marianne says and other people say, they're human beings just like we are. Everybody deserves to have some sympathy to them, their situations. And acknowledging their mistakes or their crime is the first step. But we have
to... I'd like to ask Miriam...
Yeah,
I'd like to ask Miriam a question.
Yeah.
How influential, let's say, for example, from your experiences, either in your country or here in the United States, and you've come across people who've lived in, let's say, adolescence, as Leona's talking about, who are living with either a single family household, I mean a single woman, single mother household, how influential can the parents be in a urban or ghetto environment where there's lots of gangs around? How influential can the parents be in making sure that the kids do not end up in gangs? Because I always blame the parents.
You always blame, yeah. it's the, yeah, well, as I said before in the show, I work with contextual therapy. It means that I always take the context into account and look at, try to find out which influence the context has had on that individual. That's also different, you know, it differs from person to person. In the Netherlands, we do not really have these gangs. So here in the Netherlands, the situation is different. You cannot compare countries. We have another history. We are much smaller. We have another political system, etc. But I do take that into account. And of course, parents have a large influence on the bringing up of the children and how the children develop themselves. It starts with parents. I have four kids myself.
Okay.
But before you ask, Leona, I have to get out of the show now because I have to eat with my youngest son. He just came from school. I'm sorry, but...
No, that's okay, Marion. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, it was nice to talk with you too, Joey.
Yeah, same here, Marion.
Yeah. If I'm back on the show, it's nice to meet you again then.
Thank you so much, Marion.
Yeah.
Thank you too.
Bye-bye.
Now, Joe, you had mentioned something about the gang, and I want to say this because this is a known thing too with the schools. We know around the country there's a lot of gangs, and there's a lot of kids in school that belong to gangs. And I think sometimes when these other students go to school, they're probably given a choice by these gang members or gang, some of them, to get protection. They can either get protection by joining their gangs or they can get abused by not joining. And I think they're given a choice that they're in the middle of. And a lot of times they might not say anything to their parents. I hope that they would, because if their parents know, maybe they can, I don't know what they could do, get help from the police or whatever.
Well, that's
but
one
a lot
of the
of
reasons.
These,
yeah. What? Yeah.
A lot of these adolescents, they don't know what to do.
That's one of the reasons why I brought up the question, because if you're surrounded by gangs, you're right, they want to jump kids in. And, they want to extend their dominance throughout the school. So if a kid feels that they can go to their parents with anything, then the parents might be able to help them. For example, if I were a father and I had a child who was confronted by these gangs, I would ask my child, should I go to school and talk to the principal? He would say no, because that would get him in trouble, get him beat up by the gangs. And I would say, well, if you join the gang, long term, that's going to ruin your future. What I would suggest is taking the kid to a martial arts class, because then if that kid can beat up the members of the gang, they're going to have more respect for the kid. You know, so and then move out or send the kid to boarding school. You know, but
no.
I would hope that the
boarding school is. You know, you just said it though. You know what? I actually had enrolled my son in karate years and years ago, and I enrolled myself, and we went at different times. You know, he was with the younger ones, and not that we were in a place where there were gangs. We came from a really good community, but. I think it's good to have children get involved in sports and also karate, things to protect themselves. But a lot of these kids, they're raised in the city. They're raised in places. I'm going to say something I want to say real quick, too, about the prisons, going back to the prisons and gangs. You know, I heard, it was quite a while back, I heard that they have a place that they sent gang members to that are in prison that want to leave the gang. There's a place, and I know it's in one of the states. I don't want to mention the state, but I don't know why they don't have that all over the country too. For these people that wanted distance themselves from their gangs and get themselves back on track again, this is something they need to do in the prisons.
Well, it's dangerous to do that. If a person says, I want to leave the Latin Kings, for example, Latin Kings, they're kind of like almost extinct from what I understand. The guy who showed that you went on when I introduced you to the guy, you know, to go on the show, he infiltrated the Latin Kings. He was a CI, and he became president of the Latin Kings in Connecticut. So, well, let's say the name of any other game.
That's the state that I heard that they, I don't know if it's the Department of Corrections or Department of Justice, but that's the state I heard where there's a place where they send people that want to distance themselves from their gangs in the prisons. They have a place where they send them. It's separating them from it, and it's kind of like a place that, a protective facility.
Well, they need protection, don't they? From what I understand, if you leave it, you can't leave again. You can't say, you know what, I'm 25 years old now, I've gone to college, I want to go and, you know, continue my academic studies and, you know, and work in the corporate world. They say, no, 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 you can't do that. No. So they get, you know, they get stabbed or they get assaulted if they try to leave, from what I understand. Is that right?
You know, the Tukey Williams from California, he was executed. But they say Tukey Williams was the one that started the Crips, I think. And he was in prison for years and on death row. And he ended up, I mean, he had all kinds, he was worldly known for the changes. He had, some kind of awards and everything else. And this is the man that could have helped a lot of those kids in the streets. He could have helped them because he had turned his life around. Kids look up to tough guys in the streets. They can look up to tough guys who have turned their lives around and listen to them more than they would listen to a normal counselor out in the street.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
But Arnold Schwarzenegger was the governor at the time, and he had Tukey Williams executed in spite of the fact that he had world support. And I understand that Arnold Schwarzenegger belonged to some kind of sorority, and they ended up just getting rid of him. They didn't want nothing to do with him after he executed this Tukey Williams. So it goes to show you that people acknowledge when this change is made, when somebody makes a change. And as I said, that was a prisoner that could have made a big difference in eliminating the gangs, not in increasing them. But a lot
wasn't
of
there also somebody just recently on death row who was executed, and before he died, one of his admonitions to adolescents were, do not join gangs. It is not as romantic as you think.
I
read something like that.
But, you know,
maybe
they know.
Not.
That's why I say mass incarceration doesn't need to be. You know, the Department of Justice said something about, or the Sentencing Project said something about a person, if they have committed a first offense and they've been in for over 15 or 20 years, you know, they look at their history. But I think myself, with these people on the outside, these kids on the street that are really messing up royally, I think that it would be people that have been in prison for years that can be the best role models for them on the outside now, because we don't see or hear of any role models for these kids anymore. And that's what's so sad.
Well, when you take a look Straight Talk, what's that program where they take kids, they bring them into school, into the prisons for about a few hours?
Not Tough Love, Straight.
Something Talk, Straight Talk, something like that. And mm-hmm. They're there for only a few hours, and they say, I'm changing my life around. I don't want to, not only do not want to go to prison, I don't want to be locked up with these people.
Oh, what was this? Scared Straight, that's
there
what
you
it
go.
Was.
Yeah.
Do they still do that?
I don't know.
If they don't, they should. I think it would work.
Yeah, I mean, only a few hours of actually, you know, being in the same environment with people that they, that they know are going to, let's say, teach them some lessons when they get into the, you know, into jail or into the prison.
So they're trying to make it easy. They're trying to make it easy for these adolescents, these youth today. They're trying to make it easy for them when they commit crimes. They're trying to keep them out of prison and everything. But I think everybody should have a piece of the puzzle, piece of the portion. because there's so many people who have been in, since they were in their late teens, early 20s, who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s now, still in prison with dementia, with Alzheimer's, terminally ill, you know, Parkinson's, all these things. They don't look at that. They don't look at the fact that these people have been in so long now, it's time to release them and bring in some of these newer ones that are worse off than they were when back in the days. Crime is on the rise, and it's getting worse and worse and worse.
It's on the rise because the district attorneys and the attorney generals in the state have elevated the level of felonies from, let's say, $90 or $100 to $950. That's why it's on the rise, because when you take a look at the crime now, plus you don't need cash for bail. You have no bond, no cash bail, so you can commit a crime. You can commit a crime that's nine times worse than it was before, still not go to jail, and if you end up in court, you don't have to go back to court, and you don't have to pay any kind of fine. You don't have to pay for bond because you have no cash bond. You're out on bail automatically. So there's no incentive not to commit crimes. You have people in New York City, for example, just throwing strap hangers right onto the tracks because there's no penalty.
What was that you said that they throw on the track?
The strap hangers, you know, people who ride the subways.
Oh, okay. Jeez. There's so much. Everything is, and I was talking to Marianne about this. Everything is so inconsistent in this country. Nothing falls in sync with everything. You know, I had to cancel the show earlier today because I had scheduled Mariam to come on at 1 o'clock Eastern time, not realizing that they also have the time change. So,
I had
1 o'clock and she had 6 o'clock. She had 6 o'clock. It was 7 o'clock her time, and this is what happens. We don't have consistency even. Why are we changing the time all the time? This is ridiculous. And then we have every state operating differently when it comes to the penal system. And even when people write letters, some prisoners are allowed five pages while others are allowed 11. And some prisoners, they can have as many as you want to send. So, some states have the life without parole. Some states have life. They don't have life without parole. And some places have the death penalty, other places don't. Look at Maine and Vermont. They have never taken away the rights of prisoners to vote, but every other state has. You know, this is ridiculous. How do we expect people to be normal with so much inconsistency in the United States?
No, that's because the states are sovereign states and they can establish their own rules and regulations within the state. What was I about to say? I forgot. Oh, well.
Come on, not a senior moment for you.
Oh, yes, it is.
But you know what I was saying, Joe, with the community service work? The people that commit these crimes, drive them without under the influence and all these things, those are situations they give them community services. So let them go and do volunteer work. And I'll tell you another thing with the homeless shelters. They take these people off the street at 5 o'clock in the evening. I've said this over and over again. And they put them back out in the street 7 o'clock in the morning. They don't have anything for them from 7 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. These people are on the streets. A lot of them are going to start drinking or they're going to be drugging. And 5 o'clock comes, they're not going to be able to go in because they've been using. These are issues that I have a problem with. Because if they're getting funding to have these homeless shelters, from 7 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they should bring in professionals, whether they're retired social workers, retired psychologists, retired occupational therapists, retired psychiatrists.
Well, then again, you'd still need to have people who give a damn. Remember when I was telling you about a guy that I knew? He was in the system. He was hired years ago. Haven't kept in touch with him for the past few years, but he was hired to be a counselor, not so much a counselor, but some sort of facilitator in the homeless system. you know, at a homeless shelter. He didn't care. He told me of an example where he was in charge of the rec room, and he would put on the TV show, and he would put on a TV show that he would want to see, and he didn't care what the other people wanted, you know. If they wanted to see one program and he wanted to see another, he put on what he wanted to see. They don't care.
That's what I say. In order to see success, you have to put some effort into it yourself. You have to, you know, think of it as though, is this a family member? Could this be my family member? This is how people have to think. And unfortunately, sometimes our family members can be doing the right thing, but somebody else, because they're not doing the right thing with their loved ones, can cause other people to be affected by it. And there's just so much out there that needs to be revised, remodified, something. But people don't care anymore. Look at what's happening overseas, the humanitarian crisis. Even the United Nations, no one's stepping in to try to stop all of this chaos. And it's affecting now us. It's affecting the United States. Because they're talking about the universities.
What's happening in the United States now, in my opinion, I'm a conspiracy theorist, is being done because of globalist actions. It's not being done because of common sense, and people don't care in general anyway. Unless you're a family member or a good friend of the family, people don't care about you. They only care about you in a perfunctory way. But other than that, they don't care. And what's happening to have things make sense, you have to realize that it's not supposed to make sense. It's supposed to make profit. It's supposed to be chaos. It's supposed to divide the nations in order to make it easy for globalists to take over the world. Now, that may seem like a very, very far stretch, but that has a history of being done by the Rothschilds. They're masters at it. They've been doing it for centuries with their central banks. They have the Rockefellers. They funded, you know, George Soros's. They funded operations that are absolutely against common sense and against humanity. So when you take a look at the history of dictators like Caesar, Nero, Caligula, Hitler, Stalin, etc., what is it that these people want? They want complete domination of their particular countries.
I'd like to ask
and
you, have you ever heard of One World Order?
The New World Order.
New World Order. What do you think about that? Because I've heard that so many times, it's almost like, what's going to happen? Is the world going to be controlled by, or it's already, from the way you're talking, it's already controlled by...
It's already been controlled, yeah. The New World Order is a conglomeration of the richest people in the world who, because they're so rich, they want to control the world. It's a natural instinct whenever you have power. The more power you have, the more power you want to get. So the Rothschilds, the Rockefeller, the Rothschilds in particular, they've been around not for decades, centuries. It's over 300 years they've been doing this. And they've been doing it because at that time they were becoming one of the richest families in the world. And they can control the other nations through what's called the central banks. Central banks are the facilities and entities within countries that control the currency. Here in the United States, it's called the Federal Reserve. That's our central bank. It is a separate entity. It is not part of the United States government, even though people think it is. It is a private bank. Nobody knows who the owners are. That's the same way it is in other countries. And the way these central banks work is that they put governments in debt. And as a result of putting them in debt, we're $21 trillion in debt, the United States. As a result of putting the government in debt, the government has to seek measures to try to get themselves out of debt. Then you have corrupt politicians who want to go to war, and that creates more money that's needed to go to war. That means that creates more debt. So, and the Rothschilds are getting rich off of this. And I can explain that when you have time sometime.
Yeah, I've heard the name. No. I've heard the name for years. And what you're talking about, even with the Federal Reserve and the central banks, that's been coming out a lot lately too. So, and I know this country is in deep debt. But I thought it was with China. They were in debt with China. I didn't know they were in debt with the Rothschilds and all of those wealthy.
Well, the Rothschilds, yeah. Well, the China owns $3 trillion of our debt. And, see, there should not be even one penny of debt. That's completely unnecessary. In 1913, the Federal Reserve was created by the one was the Rockefeller one, and there were three other people who were very rich. So when the Federal Reserve was created, it was created in such a way so that they would control the currency and create debt. Prior to the Federal Reserve, the United States government didn't have one penny of debt because it did not issue bonds in order to get money to fund their operations. All they did was print up the money and give it to the agencies, the government, in order for them to use it. But when the Federal Reserve came along, they instituted this issuing of bonds. In other words, we need money, but we're not going to print it. We're going to borrow it from you, you know, the American population, corporations, other nations, and then at the end of the year, we're going to pay you back interest. So we're going to borrow the money. We're going to borrow $2 trillion. Then we're going to give you back the $2 trillion we borrowed. And in addition to the 10% interest that we're going to give you, we're going to give you 10% of $2 trillion is $200 billion. We're also going to give you $200 billion when it could have been zero debt.
So, there's,
so that's why I say, huh?
Do they also profit? Do they also profit off the prisons as well?
Well, any entity, anything that makes money for the government or has to have the government fund an agency, they make money off of it because in order to get the money, they have to issue bonds. When they issue bonds, the Federal Reserve either buys those bonds or other countries buy the bonds, and the interest, when the Federal Reserve buys the bonds, then it pays itself interest.
How in the world do we have in this country, how do we have the average citizen? I mean, I see poverty and I see wealth, but I don't see anything in between. I see very, very little in between. It's almost as though the wealthy are taken over completely.
Well, it is. There's no middle class anymore. The wealth has taken over, and they're preparing for the 2020 agenda, 2030 agenda. That's the takeover of the world. So that when you see food plants going up in smoke, when you have railroad trains being derailed and food being splattered all over the landscape there, when you have wars like Hamas and Israel, Ukraine and Russia, when you have inflation, all of that is done on purpose in order for these rich bastards to their major goal in order for them to become dictators of the world. Have you ever heard of transhumanism?
Mm-mm.
Transhumanism, that's the philosophy and the action in which these particular people, they want to transfer their life, their consciousness, into the bodies of robots and androids so that they can live forever. It's called the singularity also.
Jeez.
So that's their goal. In order for them to become dictators, they don't want to die. They want to become immortal. They want to become gods. And the technology today is being advanced in such a way that in a few years, they just might be able to do it. And these when I talk about rich families, I'm not talking about billions of dollars. They're worth trillions of dollars. They influence governments by bribing them, by blackmailing them, by threatening them. They get away with it because they're that rich.
I'd like to know why as you mentioned, we're in so deep in debt. How in the world is all this money going over to Ukraine and Israel in the trillions, in the weapons and everything else? What is left to this country if this country were to be attacked?
Well, not yet. Not only the money, but the munitions. They're sending over munitions to the Ukraine and probably to Israel as well. So in case there is some sort of an attack, we don't have a lot of armaments left in order to protect ourselves. We don't have backup, or a lot of it anyway. So that's part of the plan, you know. That's part of the, you know, divide and conquer. And then when they conquer, somebody's going to be the dictators, and that's the plan.
So you really believe this is like a conspiracy that's happening worldwide, globally?
Oh, it's absolutely.
Joe, that's why I like it when you come on the show, because you always have interesting things to talk. One last thing. There's been a lot of talk, even the government admits it now, but about UFOs. And they said there's been over – I keep thinking it's over 500 UFO sightings since January. But they were talking about UFOs. They were spending a lot of time over Arizona. And they couldn't figure out why Arizona, but they've been spotted all over the country. What are your thoughts on UFOs and the government activities as well?
Well, from what I've seen, I don't know. I don't have first-hand experience, but everything that I talk about is from what I've read, and then I just put together what I've read with what my experiences are. When it comes to politics, you can't have what we have today if you actually had honest politicians. But getting to your question of the UFOs, supposedly the UFOs that people are looking at are not really UFOs. They're really aircraft designed by, for example, the United States as a result of the crash in Roswell back in the 1940s and 1950s. And American scientists reverse-engineered what that UFO craft was, and they've created UFO-looking craft to test out, you know, their expertise, to test out the engineering, to test out anti-gravity and new technologies. So, and other people will say that UFOs do exist, other people will say.
I watch the History Channel a lot, and also SCI, and one of the things they seem to think is, as a matter of fact, talking about conspiracies, they actually have mentioned the government being involved with not only UFOs but aliens, some kind of connection. I don't know how to explain it, but they talk about it, and I'm wondering if we have aliens in the human body in this country, or it may be around the world, I don't know, but actually that are not of human, not of us, but they look like
us.
Well,
I believe aliens are here. You know why? I don't have solid gold proof, but I come to that conclusion through induction.
Exactly.
There is a movement around the world to terraform the planet. Now, you've heard of Bill Gates' plan to block out the sun. All of this because of climate change, and he wants to do it in order to block out the dangerous rays of the sun. And then there's, oh my God, there are government projects that are designed to take out from the atmosphere carbon dioxide. They say it's a dangerous gas. It contributes to climate change. It is dangerous for the environment. Carbon dioxide is what helps keep us alive. Carbon dioxide is what trees need in order for them to produce oxygen. Without carbon dioxide, trees can't produce oxygen and we die. So I ask myself, why are trillions of dollars being employed to, I forget the name, you know how when the plane passes over and you see that the billow stream behind it? I forget the name of it now. But the efforts to block out the sun, the efforts to take away carbon dioxide, why do it? If you're going, this will terraform the planet, this will destroy the planet. Why would you destroy the planet? If you're a human being, you need the planet. You need sunshine, you need air, you need fresh water in order to live. But these people are killing the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So why kill the planet if you're a human being? You would kill the planet if you're not a human being, but an alien, and you need the planet to become more poisonous, no oxygen, no fresh water in order to support your species. So I believe that it's very possible that aliens are here and they're in control.
I'll tell you, we've run out of time, but I'm going to say one thing. There has to be, because and I know that you probably don't believe in the Bible, but in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 1, you get a Bible, you look in the book of Ezekiel, they're describing a UFO. I don't think the people knew back then what they were seeing, but the description of it is exactly the same that they're talking about now with these UFOs. So I don't know if, and I know that the government has been examining recently too an alien, a deceased alien. They've been examining that to try to find out. They said it's not of human, but they don't know what it is. They said they can't claim it to be an alien, but they know it's not human. So what else would it be? So there's a lot of mysteries going on right now, and it's getting to the point now where this whole world is in a chaotic state. So people incarcerated, they have to realize they're behind those walls, but there's so much going on outside that can affect them inside as well as all of us. So it's almost like I can't explain what's happening in this world, but I know something is definitely happening. But I want to thank you.
Well, the best way, when you take...
Pardon?
Huh?
What were you saying?
When you take a look at everything that doesn't make sense, then you have to take a look at what does make sense, even if it's far out there.
Exactly.
I believe that aliens are here, you know. People don't, as a matter of fact, matter of rule, people don't care about other people. You know the politicians have been corrupt. As a matter of fact, Congress, I was reading a book the other day, and Congress has its own investigative arm, and they report every year about, you know, corrupt politicians. Do you know that between, what was it, the years of 1997, or say 1995 to 2010, okay, that Congress published the report saying that there were 50,000 politicians who had been indicted for one thing or another. 50,000, okay, 50,000. So if you say, well, 50,000 have been indicted, I believe in the cockroach theory. I believe, you know, for every rotten politician that you know of, there's about 10 more that you don't know of. So 50,000 are well known because they had to go through the legal system. There's got to be at least 500,000 that we don't know of that are just as criminal as those who have been caught.
But they don't get
judged. System. No, they escape the system. They're in charge of it. So they find one way or another so that they're not caught. That's why we're in the problem. Think of it, Leona, if you, let's say anybody that you knew positively was an honest, intelligent human being, and you had 500 people just like that in Congress, there's 435, I think, senators and congressmen in Congress. And if they were honest, would we be in the state we're in today?
Mm-mm. No way.
No.
No way.
Right. Mm-mm. So that means that we have a lot of dishonest people in there, a lot of dishonest and weak people. Stupid, weak, but mainly dishonest.
Look at the gag order. I mean, this judge is a joke because she's finding a former president. 5,000 here, 10,000 here. That's a drop in the bucket for him. You know, that's like giving 5 cents to the, and he can continue. You know, I hate to laugh about it, but he is an entertainer, and he's a strong-willed person. Whether I like him or not, I have to say there's such a big difference when it comes to strength and weakness between a former and current. But like I say, I didn't realize there were that many, 55,000 that have been in, involved.
50,000 have been indicted, right, and that's been reported by Congress. Within a span of time, I think like 10 years, 15 years, I think 97 to 2010, something like that.
Wow.
50,000.
Like you said, if they were honest, we probably wouldn't be in the state of disaster as we are now. Not at all.
If you knew, let's say you know people that you would absolutely believe in are completely honest, right, and intelligent, and have common sense, and they have the welfare of people at heart. You wouldn't have the kind of society we have today. You wouldn't have the type of government we have today.
No. No. It's sad. It's sad that we have to be in a country like this, but that's the way it is, I guess. But, Joe, we've run out of time, so I want to thank you again for coming on. And what's today? Today is Thursday, right? So we have Saturday, 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time is Tahaka Amana Albay. Monday, Reginald Clements. And Tuesday, we will be back on track with Dave Van Veen and Marique Joanne Gills and also Andy Williams at 5:30. And then hopefully next Wednesday, I think we'll have back with Franz Dell from the Netherlands. I think it's
fine. Hey, are you cutting back on your shows? Because if you continue to do two shows a day, your body could break down.
I do on Tuesdays. I do two shows, but I think Tuesdays is the only ones. Periodically, I might end up doing a two on another day, but right now Tuesday's the only time, and it's I believe only for the month of November. Yeah, I'm trying to cut back on a lot because I'm getting older now and things are getting But I want
to it's time to enjoy retirement years, you know. People don't get old so that they work more. People get old so that they can relax.
You know, I had like 7 years left to get a full retirement years and years ago, and unfortunate tragedy happened back then, but I've never been able to retire since. The only thing is I don't get paid like I used to. But other than that, I get my message, though, and that's the most important thing. But I want to thank you, as always, for coming on. And like I said, anytime, Joe, thank you so much. You're always welcome to come on.
And I'll see you next time.
Okay.
Okay, and you enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you, Joe. You too. Audience, we are now going to end this episode. I thank everyone for listening in, and I hope you all have benefited from what you have heard. Thank you so much, and we are now ending this episode.